for the Pacifica Radio Network and Planet Waves FM. This is the Miracle Hour. My name is Eric Francis Compolino, broadcasting from Kingston, New York. Today is March 13th, 2016. Welcome to our program. Today happens to be the 30th anniversary of the arrival of the Course in Miracles books in my life. That's kind of crazy. I'm sure that you've noticed some of these anniversaries going by and wondered where the time has gone. And I kind of do and kind of don't wonder that. I think my life has been pretty productive since that day in March of 1986 when I was living in Buffalo, New York. And it was certainly a turning point in my life. And I have always kind of remembered the date, March 13th. As being kind of a really threshold moment. And today I'd like to look at a passage in A Course in Miracles that comes from page 313. I kind of picked up the number 313 as kind of a personal identifier for myself over the years, and actually wrote a book of poems that I read from a couple of weeks ago, also called 313. And the kind of master passage of the Course in Miracles for me, one of the things that's really at the center of the whole thought philosophy, is from right in the middle of the textbook, from page 313. That is called The Illusion and the Reality of Love. And in a little while, after a few opening thoughts, I would like to read to you from that. I realize that we are going from basically kind of a cursory look at the Course. I've given a little bit of a survey the past few weeks, looking at initially in the first edition, my own involvement and how that happened and what that meant for me, and then went through four of the volumes of the text in previous editions, all available, by the way, planetwaves.fm. There's a category on, category next to each program, and you can just click on that category and you get all the programs so far. So, opening thoughts here, thinking about this a bit, and connecting with the motive for why it is that, one would open up A Course in Miracles. Now, that's kind of obvious to some people, and there just seem to be some folks whose thing in life is spiritual exploration, is kind of trying to look beyond the veil of what we see in this life and to get a little bit deeper. And there are others who are motivated by the desire for personal healing, and others who are motivated by the desire for planetary healing. And I think that all of these motives work beautifully with A Course in Miracles and make it worth the effort, which is on a few levels. As I've been saying, one of the levels of A Course in Miracles is just getting past the language to the material. But I would contend that's not as difficult as it might seem. And if you can kind of step aside from the idea that words have an absolute value and remember that all words have a symbolic value, and we can make words mean what we want them to mean. If you did an experiment where you got a bunch of people to change the references to blue, green, and red, and have blue stand for red and red stand for green and so forth, after a while these words would take on the meaning that we gave them, the new meaning that we gave them. And that's kind of how it is with A Course in Miracles, that you let the words be symbols. And there's something much more important than the symbols, as is written in one of my favorite passages that I'm going to read today from the Course. Symbols stand for something else. And it's that something else that we're seeking when we look at what symbols mean. It's very easy to get caught up in the symbolism of it all, as if symbols themselves are the thing. I see this happening a lot with people who study astrology because the symbols are all so intriguing. You know, this whole symbolic frame of reference that you're in can seem to be the thing itself, when really working with astrology, it's essential, and other esoteric systems, it's essential to remember that you are using this to get somewhere, that whether we're talking about tarot cards, astrology, A Course in Miracles, Tibetan Buddhism, it is a raft that we take across a distance and then basically leave the raft behind when we get to the other shore. You know, you can't drag the raft along with you. The raft was great crossing the water, but once you have to, walk on the land and climb mountains and things, it doesn't help to have that, you know, whole system weighing you down. And so I think that one of the more intelligently designed things about A Course in Miracles is its method of focusing the student on themselves, first of all, on their experience, on the importance of understanding the way that they perceive reality, that is to say, the way that you perceive reality, and to keep the focus on that choice of how to perceive at all times, and to remember that basically the thing that's going on, this thing that we call spiritual growth or meaning or whatever it is, ultimately comes down to a choice about how to perceive and how to interpret symbols. And so we're doing this all the time. We're making these interpretations of symbols all the time. And the choice of how to interpret things becomes a teaching example. I think we read last week or 2 weeks ago, you teach your faith in the thought system that you want. And so you choose that thought system and you demonstrate your embrace of it or exploration of it as a conscious act, and that becomes the teaching example. But the Course, again, cleverly keeps the focus on you and the decisions that you make, and the reminder that in your decisions is an example that you make, and that works pretty good. But on the personal level of, I think that the personal healing, planetary healing, and the choice to go beyond the veil or look beyond the veil are natural. I think they're organic. I think that in any person who is in a vaguely conscious process of waking up, there are going to be these questions. And it's likely that for those people, the dogmatic form of religion, where you're basically told what to believe rather than involved in any kind of an inquiry process, there's just kind of rules given, satisfies or seems to fairly large portion of the population. It certainly can keep them busy. But beyond a certain point, it's necessary to start asking your own questions and not accepting prefabricated answers, but rather accepting what you personally can be witness to and knowing the difference, right? I mean, it's easy for belief systems to be circular and for logic to be circular, and that can seem, amazing. To have circular logic that points back to itself can seem like some huge intellectual feat that's just positively brilliant. But circular logic is circular logic. And so in experimenting with ideas, it's kind of good to point yourself out of those ideas and to look back at them and have some perspective, some means of asking yourself questions. And one of the things I do appreciate about the Course in Miracles is, though it's written in religious sounding lingo, actually it seems to point you back to yourself and to engaging in a kind of an inner confrontation. Perhaps is too strong of a word, but it is sort of a confrontation, and to not merely accept anything, but rather, you know, purely on faith, but rather to let experience teach you. And it's interesting going through a number of different belief systems that I've worked with over the years, how suspicious people can be of belief, particularly of not belief, of experience. People who teach belief systems can be suspicious of belief. I mean, for example, I was reading about the ancient Greeks and in a book by Richard Tarnas, one of our more erudite and scholarly astrologers, wrote a book that's used in university-level philosophy class called The Passion of the Western Mind. If you want a good primer of Western philosophy, that's a good one. It's well-written, and Rick is a smart guy. And I opened up to the chapter on the ancient Greeks, and turns out that one of the things that ancient Greek philosophy seemed to be a response to was a lack of trust in experience, because experience is all over the map, right? And so, we need a kind of idealized version of reality that we kind of make up in philosophy, and then we're going to stick to that. It's a bit dogmatic. Another example is homeopathy. The homeopath whose ideas modern homeopathy is based on, a guy named Kent, who kind of reinterpreted Hahnemann, the inventor, himself said, no, you know, we have to work from theory to reality. We can't work from reality to theory, meaning experience. We can't learn much from experience. But the problem with that is obvious, which is that people are going to learn from experience. Experience is ultimately the most potent teacher for any person, would seem, because we believe what we experience. And so if we inject this idea that, you know, things must be true in theory before they're true in reality, it sounds like a long road to take, and who knows where it would lead. We don't really know anyway. So I'm suggesting here that that A Course in Miracles is pointed toward experience, and that it is the experiences that are the real teacher. And my central thought here is that if you are craving real experience, if you're craving deeper knowledge, then you owe it to yourself to give yourself that. And if you feel as if it is time for you to embark on a conscious healing process and to make that part of your daily and even hourly life, where if, you know, living in a way that's not focused around a purpose or focused around the purpose of healing is not serving you, then focus your life around the purpose of healing. Give yourself that. Try that for a while. See what that is like for you and see where your experiences lead you. See where that journey takes you. So the Course in Miracles is largely a work about relationships. You know, you start with the lessons, and the lessons are not as focused on relationships as the text is. The lessons are more about individual mind training and learning how to actually understand that this thing that we call the ego or the mind is much more flexible and transparent and subject to leadership than we might think. I think it was Alan Cohen, one of the early Course in Miracles teachers, who said that the ego makes a great slave and a terrible master. And so the idea is to be the master yourself and then to use what amounts to a kind of an operating system. You know, was it my soul that got this recording set up, or does my mind and body just know how to get my gear in order and music and record a program. So the ego, in that sense, served as my slave. It's my kind of mind and body array, and I have a purpose, and I gave it a purpose. So that's really what the lessons are about. The workbook lessons are about learning to see the relationship between the different facets of experience and just basically pointing you deeper. This is not a big deal. And though it, you know, can be made into one, so can anything. The textbook is much more focused on relating to people and the theme of relationships. And one of the themes in the textbook that is a recurring theme, dependably recurring theme, is the special relationship. It's a term of art from A Course in Miracles. I haven't really seen it anywhere before A Course in Miracles. Some people have picked up on it. And it is basically one of the central teachings in A Course in Miracles is the problem of this thing called the special relationship. And it's a pretty simple idea. It's pretty much the way we have relationships. It's like, I'm special and you're special, and we're going to get together and be special. We're going to do something special, and it'll be me and you and me, and that's how it's going to be. And A Course in Miracles takes a bit of a different approach, which is to treat everyone you encounter on the same plane of reality and to understand the issues of specialness in any form, including the specialness of the course itself, the specialness of you, and specialness of, you know, everyone you feel special about. And you start to think of the word special in a different way after you ponder this. And I can never use the word special without coming to a full stop and ask myself if that's really the word that I want to use. But what the Course in Miracles means by the special relationship is an excluding relationship of one kind of ego identity to another that has a way of pushing out everything else and therefore is not subject to what you might think of as spiritual intervention. I'm still not sure how to say these things because I haven't restated them into language specifically about A Course in Miracles. I've been learning how to talk about them without ever referencing A Course in Miracles. So now I've given myself this little puzzle of how to reference it. So in a sense, I guess that what I'm trying to say here is that if you choose someone for some special purpose and that's it, there is a massive swath of teaching in A Course in Miracles that says, okay, here is the thing that's blocking you from experiencing God directly. I recognize this is controversial, and it is probably the thing least often spoken about regarding A Course in Miracles, that it is fairly clear that A Course in Miracles is talking about the path to awakening heavily, seriously involving a commitment to not selecting certain people and making them special. And if you see the torment that our society goes through by the infliction of the drive for special, possessive, exclusive relationships, it's pretty easy to see why they're getting at this. What is the issue here? And the issue is that these relationships, in the opinion of the material in the course, are what reinforce the concept of separation, not the concept of joining, and they serve to distract us, take us away from ourselves, and to block us from a huge amount of love and opportunity to share. And the only reason it's controversial is because we've been told so many times over and over again that there's just one way to have relationships. And A Course in Miracles is saying, well, there needs to be a different way to have relationships if you're going to have this process work at any kind of dependable speed. And the thing is that we do need to help ourselves now. We see what happens when we waste precious time and watch our society have all kinds of problems and watch our lives go by. And I'm here to suggest that the time is now and that we need to consider some different ideas about relationships. So after a little bit of music, I'm planning to at least begin reading to you one of the chapters in A Course in Miracles right from the middle of the text, called The Illusion and the Reality of Love. It's from the old page 313 in the original materials, the ones that were, you know, the original, like, published version of the course. And let's see how that goes and where that goes. So let's listen to a little bit of music from a recent Vision Quest session, and I'll be back in a moment. Vision Quest Ensemble from a recent exploratory recording session. We are in music working with an idea that I first learned from A Course in Miracles, which is don't plan what you're doing, just do it and see what happens. So that's what we're doing in these Vision Quest sessions. We kind of start with a very loose concept and then set the instruments up and move from place to place and let it happen. So this segment of A Course in Miracles is from a chapter called The Forgiveness of Illusions, and it's one of the sub-chapters in that chapter. And the person who turned me onto it when I was pretty new to the course and hadn't read too far into the materials said, yeah, this is where a lot of the central teaching is contained, just in this very short passage. But you may find it challenging. And in any event, let's hear what is going on in the words of Dr. Helen Schuchman and whatever influence was guiding her to write. The Illusion and the Reality of Love. Be not afraid to look upon the special hate relationship, for freedom lies in looking at it. It would be impossible not to know the meaning of love except for this. for the special love relationship, in which the meaning of love is hidden, is undertaken solely to offset the hate but not let it go. All right, that is, I think, three sentences. Let's read them again. And note the distinction here that the authors are making between the special love relationship and the special hate relationship. Ultimately, they're the same thing, but seem to have different forms. So it begins with a kind of a command. Be not afraid to look upon the special hate relationship, for freedom lies in looking at it. It would be impossible not to know the meaning of love except for this, except for looking at the special hate relationship. If you don't look at it, they're saying you're not going to quite figure this out. Look at the special hate relationship, and it will be impossible not to figure it out. Four, the special love relationship in which the meaning of love is hidden, is undertaken solely to offset the hate, but not let it go. Your salvation will rise clearly before your open eyes as you look at this. You cannot limit hate. The special love relationship will not offset it, but merely drive it underground and out of sight. It is essential to bring it into sight and to make no attempt to hide it, for it is the attempt to balance hate with love that makes love meaningless to you. The extent of the split that lies in this you do not realize, and until you do, the split will remain unrecognized and therefore unhealed. Just responding to this as if it was the first time I'd ever read these words, it is one of those things like good poetry or any good literature that can seem completely new every time you read it anew. And I'm not sure I've read this out loud. Okay, so I'm going to read this yet again and really let the text as written have most of the work. And I'm going to try to read it without interrupting myself. So I'm going to read the whole paragraph again slowly and then offer a little comment and then move on. Be not afraid to look upon the special hate relationship, for freedom lies in looking at it. It would be impossible not to know the meaning of love except for this, for the special love relationship, in which the meaning of love is hidden, is undertaken solely to offset the hate, but not let it go. Your salvation will rise clearly before your open eyes as you look on this. You cannot limit hate. The special love relationship will not offset it, but will merely drive it underground, and out of sight. It is essential to bring it into sight and to make no attempt to hide it, for it is the attempt to balance hate with love that makes love meaningless to you. The extent of the split that lies in you, you do not realize. And until you do, the split will remain unrecognized and therefore unhealed. So the syllogism setup is that there seem to be two kinds of special relationships. Special hate relationship, where you hate the person, you love to hate them, and the special love relationship, where you love them and you don't really hate them, but that drives the hate underground. And then what happens typically is you wonder, baby, where did our love go? Why do we love each other? Now we hate each other. Well, this is this dance between the special hate relationship and the special love relationship. That embarking on the special love relationship drives the hate underground, but then eventually the hate comes to the surface because it wasn't resolved. And the thing suggested here, again in religious terminology, maybe we'll find a better way to describe it, is that you have your choice of the special relationship, or its two forms, or holy relationship, a relationship based on the individual's mutual experience of God, basically. It is relationship that you might say is coming from a place of an inner connection to the Holy Spirit rather than ego to ego. And this is, as much as it annoys me to be using these terms, I've got to say, I have to just kind of suppress my inner editor as I'm doing it all the time. I have found this to be a profound teaching, that if the setup of a relationship is, I am coming from a strong place of my connection, and you're coming from a strong place of my your connection, and my agenda is based on my growth and healing and relationship to God, and your agenda is based on your growth, healing, and your relationship to God, now we have loads of room for common ground. And the power of that agenda, service, and supporting one another in our inner quest makes for much more harmonious, or at least purposeful, relationships. All right, next paragraph. The symbols of hate against the symbols of love play out a conflict that does not exist. For symbols stand for something else, and the symbol of love is without meaning if love is everything. You will go through this last undoing quite unharmed, and will at last emerge as yourself. This is the last step in the readiness for God. Be not unwilling now. You are too near, and you will cross the bridge in perfect safety, translated quietly from war to peace. For the illusion of love will never satisfy, but its reality, which awaits you on the other side, will give you everything. Now, of course, this is meaningful mostly because we recognize what they're talking about, right? It wouldn't be reading a book about how to fix your leaky roof wouldn't be nearly as meaningful if your roof had never leaked. If you had the most awesome, perfect Atlantean magic roof that lasted forever, you might not feel any inspiration at all from a book about how to fix your roof. But if you have water dripping in every place and it's getting everything wet and making your house smell like mold, you might be very interested in reading a book about how to fix your roof. And that, to me, is how this material comes off. It's like, you are speaking to a problem, I say to the text, that I had not given... I had not articulated, but by the time I was working with this at age like 23, I had had enough relationships and seen the patterns forming and had enough conflict in my relationships that I was personally in tune with the relevance of these ideas personally. So let's go on. If we want to read that paragraph again, let's read that paragraph again. Take our time here. There is no rush, and I think if you grasp one concept out of this whole thing, you're very far along the way to grasping the whole thing, because it's holographic, and one idea has the ability to change the rest of them. Paragraph 2. The symbols of hate against the symbols of love play out a conflict that does not exist. For symbols stand for something else, and the symbol of love is without meaning if love is everything. Let's focus that. The symbols of hate against the symbols of love, play out a conflict that does not exist. For symbols stand for something else, and the symbol of love is without meaning if love is everything. The symbol of love is without meaning if love is everything. We don't need a symbol for what already is everything. You'll go through this last undoing quite unharmed and will last emerge as yourself. This is the last step in the readiness for God. Be not unwilling now. You are too near and will cross the bridge in perfect safety, translated quietly from war to peace. The illusion of love will never satisfy, but its reality, which awaits you on the other side, will give you everything. And by the way, by the other side, they're not talking about going to heaven. They're talking about the other side of your thoughts, the choice to sort of switch brainwaves and cross an inner bridge. Remember, before I talked about the extent of the split that lies in you, you don't realize. So it's about healing that split, that division. Let's read on. The special love relationship is an attempt to limit the destructive effects of hate by finding a haven in the storm of guilt. It makes no attempt to rise above the storm into the sunlight. On the contrary, it emphasizes the guilt outside the haven by attempting to build barricades against it and keep within them. The special love relationship is not perceived as a value in itself, but is a place of safety from which hatred is split off and kept apart. The special love partner is acceptable only as long as he or she serves this purpose. Hatred can enter and is indeed welcome in some aspects of the relationship, but it is still held together by the illusion of love. If the illusion goes, the relationship is broken or becomes unsatisfying on the grounds of disillusionment. Love is not an illusion. It is a fact. Where disillusionment is possible, there was not love, but hate. For hate is an illusion, and what can change was never love. It is sure that those who select certain ones as partners in any aspect of living and use them for any purpose which they would not share with others are trying to live with guilt rather than die of it. That is the choice they see, and love to them is only an escape from death. They seek it desperately, but not in the peace it would gladly come quietly to them. And when they find the fear of death is still upon them, the love relationship loses the illusion that it is what it is not. The barricades against it are broken, and fear rushes in, and hatred triumphs. Here today on my 30th, three-decade, that's crazy, anniversary of encountering this material, I can say pretty confidently that this one paragraph, paragraph four, the one beginning with love is not an illusion, is probably the central teaching in the whole work as applied practically to relationships. So I'm going to read it again. I'm going to do a lot of rereading in this because you have to read this stuff over and over again. And over time and see how it goes in and changes. And here we go. This is from chapter 16, sub 4, paragraph 4. Love is not an illusion. It is a fact. where disillusionment is possible, there was not love, but hate. For hate is an illusion, and what can change was never love. It is sure that those who select certain ones as partners in any aspect of living, and to use them for any purpose which they would not share with others, are trying to live with guilt rather than die of it. That is the choice they see, and love to them is only an escape from death. They seek it desperately, but not in the peace in which it would gladly come quietly to them. And when they find the fear of death is still upon them, the love relationship loses the illusion that it is what it is not. The barricades against it are broken, fear rushes in, and hatred triumphs. Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you've built against it. It is not necessary to seek for what is true, but it is necessary to seek for what is false. Every illusion is one of fear, whatever form it takes. And the attempt to escape from one illusion to another must fail. If you seek love outside yourself, you can be certain that you perceive hatred within, and that you're afraid of it. Yet peace will never come from the illusion of love, but only from its reality. For a very long time, it was hard for me to follow, to parse out some of the syntax, or seemingly some of the syntax. Particularly one statement, and I'd like to zoom in on that one statement, because in it contains a philosophy of not only of relationships, but the way in which we can guide our relationships to become basically inevitable forums for healing rather than these things they tend to become, very often nightmare scenarios. You know, I have spent, I would say, way too much time as an astrologer helping people deal with the toxic effects of their relationships, and this offers a certain key to unraveling that. So let's look at this again. Paragraph 4 in this section. Love is not an illusion. It is a fact. Where disillusionment is possible, there was not love, but hate. For hate is an illusion. And what can change was never love. Okay. So this is an idea that these variances and these reversals of position indicate that there's something else going on in the relationship besides what we call love. Love is a kind of a byword in our society. It means different things to everyone, but any culture that could come up with the expression, indeed extol its virtue, all is fair in love and war, is equating war with love, saying basically that love is a battlefield, as I'm not sure what pop artist said that. And we tend to believe this BS and proceed in our relationships as if it's true. And we wonder how it is that our lives go nowhere and why we keep having the same relationship, 10 times, often with one of our parents. So, hate is an illusion, and what can change was never love. Here's the crux of the biscuit, in my opinion. It is sure that those who select certain ones as partners in any aspect of living and use them for any purpose which they would not share with others are trying to live with guilt rather than die of it. That is the choice they see. Love to them is an escape from death. Trying to live with guilt rather than die of it. So this is to say, the obsession on exclusivity and exclusion does not address the guilt or the jealousy. It's the attempt to live with it rather than die of it. This is the thing that always blows my mind about people who insist that monogamy is the only way because it's supposed to be some kind of a hedge against jealousy and against the guilt of succumbing to temptation of someone else. When it would certainly seem that this description of the special love relationship is this barricade that is built to attempt to keep the guilt outside the relationship rather than to let it come rushing in is the very essence of the way that we're taught to have relationships. And it's frightening to do something else when, first of all, you don't have any idea you can work from. And here's some validity of it helps to have an idea. That I was just suggesting a moment ago might not be so true. But hey, here we have an idea. We have somewhere to work from. And the notion that there is some underlying ground of reality that we're not accessing through having these relationships that are havens from the storm of guilt, basically. So you might feel like, well, I really want all these beautiful, hot people, or I've got a crush on that guy over in the next cubicle, but I'm in a monogamous relationship, and I have my relationship, and I value that, and I'm not going to do anything that would make me feel guilty. Of course, by that time, you already feel guilty, because it's never the action that leads to the feeling of guilt. It's the feeling of guilt that leads to the feeling of guilt, and as far as I know, most people feel guilty for wanting to exceed the seeming boundary in the relationship. And that boundary is basically, in the words of this nifty little segment, a barricade against the storm of guilt. All right. I skipped a paragraph. Let's take a look at that. continues from when the barricades are against it are broken. That is to say, the fear of death and guilt. Fear rushes in and hatred triumphs. Paragraph 5. There are no triumphs of love. Only hate is at all concerned with the, quote, triumph of love. By the way, this will change how you feel about movies if you let it. Because movies are always talking about the triumph of love. Love triumphs. Now we have a indication here, subject to fact-checking, as is everything in print. There are no triumphs of love. Only hate is at all concerned with the triumph of love. The illusion of love can triumph over the illusion of hate, but always at the price of making both illusions. As long as the illusion of hatred lasts, so long will love be an illusion to you. And then the only choice remaining possible is which illusion you prefer. There is no conflict in the choice between truth and illusion. Seen in these terms, no one would hesitate. But conflict enters the instant that choice seems to be one between illusions. But this choice does not matter. Where one choice is as dangerous as the other, the decision must be one of despair. This kind of logic is one of the reasons why I love A Course in Miracles. This bald stripping down of psychology that is it's believable, and it may just simply be true, but it is testable. This line is testable. Conflict enters the instant seems to be excuse me, the instant the choice seems to be one between illusions. Conflict enters the instant that a choice seems to be one between illusions. But this choice does not matter. Where one choice is as dangerous as the other, the decision must be one of despair. You can use this all day long. Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself you've built against it. And by the way, if you do this, you're going to find all these barriers that you've built against love and wonder, what the heck am I doing here? And however am I going to get rid of it? However, it is a necessary step along the way to find those barriers, most of which are beliefs, and thought forms, and things from culture that we accept mindlessly, and bad examples set by other people who do this without any questions. Every illusion is one of fear, whatever form it takes, and the attempt to escape from one illusion to the other must fail. If you seek love outside yourself, you can be certain you perceive hatred within and are afraid of it. Yet peace will never come from the illusion of love, but only from its reality. Recognize this, for it is true, and the truth must be recognized if it is to be distinguished from illusion. The special love relationship is an attempt to bring love into separation. And as such, it's nothing more than an attempt to bring love into fear and make it real in fear. In fundamental violation of love's one condition, the special love relationship would accomplish the impossible. How but in illusion can this be done? It's essential that we look very closely at exactly what it is you think you can do to solve the dilemma, which seems very real to you, but which does not exist. You have come close to truth, and only this stands between you and the bridge that leads you into it. Gee whiz. So, this has a lot of implications. And it is, it's worth having a gander at, I think. You know, if this resonates with you, you can, you know, try it out. These ideas are pretty simple, although they require looking at the world from a different viewpoint. And it's the workbook exercises that help you get little tastes of that different viewpoint and to see little glimmers of light come through. And I would strongly encourage continuing to work with the workbook consistently, even if you don't feel like you are getting any real results out of it. So we're almost out of time. I'm going to end today with a poem in which I lifted one particular line that I just read to you. This piece is called Autobiographical Note 1288. What can I say about all the minutes of those days, the miles of those journeys, the states of mind, and the games of solitaire? Fast abandoning tabs on the lost and the retrieved as time thunders laughing across the thresholds of the years. I had tumbled back into some new gape of the ancient dream, deceived in believing I was deceived, desiring for the prison of want, searching for some gender between the oppressed and the oppressor, and then streamed with a great perk of bile from the labyrinth that was never there. You have come close to truth, and only this stands between you and the bridge that leads you to it. I opened my eyes, my rib was returned. Hope is a hard love to part for the hopeful. Then met with the vision of this precipitous beginning, a child in my arms, tame and wild cats all around me. Now, said the voice, step out lightly, but I could not see the crossing. Vision can deceive, and so I learned to listen, basking, as I am, in the light of the invisible sun. Thanks for listening. Hello to all you folks out there on the New Hampshire-Vermont border, listening to Miracle Hour on WOOL. I'm going to sign off for the day. This has been the sixth edition of the Miracle Hour. My name is Eric Francis Coppolino. You may reach me at efc@ericfrancis.com. Try me again if I don't reply right away. And the place to find all of these programs and much else is planetwaves.fm. It has been a pleasure hanging out here with you today, and I'll catch you a different time. Bye for now.